She's been doing so much reading this morning. I said, do you want to just read my sermon for me? I mean, you're already doing a fine job. And speaking of fine, when we were editing the bulletin, apparently we wrote about fine husbands instead of five husbands. But I think that has to wait for another time. But, and speaking of misprints in the bulletin, obviously the title of the sermon is a bit of a misprint. Worship, water, and war. Certainly not the vibe we're going for today. Plus those three things have nothing in common. I mean, especially when we think about our place in history as people of faith, right? Okay, now that I hear it out loud, if we examine our specific intersection of American Christianity, and as Kim just read for us, our history of westward expansion and the devastation of lands and native tribes and families. Okay, maybe that's not the best place to start right now. I mean, after all, we're in the middle of a hopeful transition, right? A resurrection of sorts here at Ames UCC. We've endured a long season of an interim time, of a waiting time. After the departure of Reverend Eileen Gebbie in 2021, there have been significant changes. A lot has happened. The physical building that we're in has been updated, secured, cared for, all the way down to the literal foundations where wood and Iowa earth met. Us, the people of this community, we have changed from the inside out. There have been births and deaths. There have been baptisms and confirmations. We've celebrated holidays. We've welcomed new members. And we hold an open space at the communion table for those who join us now only in spirit. There have been many returns as well for us in worship. Worship with the Lamas at Hobbits Hill. There have been the return of rummage sales and other parties and gatherings. And the simple fact that we can see each other's complete faces some of the time, this was also a long-awaited return. And in the weeks to come, pastors Hannah and Betsy will be installed as co-pastors of this growing community, which in and of itself is an adaptation, a change from the old model of senior and associate pastor. So there's a lot of grieving that has happened over the past few years. A lot has changed, and some of it very quickly. And grief doesn't really have a timeline. It kind of creeps up on us when we're least expecting it. So we find ourselves lingering in the space between what was and what is. And we recognize that there has been a significant amount of energy, prayer, conversation, study, discerning what's coming next. Our search committee, executive team, leadership teams throughout this community have prayerfully considered what vision the Spirit is calling us toward. What is this still speaking God already affirming in our lives? Who and what are we? For what purpose does our community exist? What is our role as a faith community? And how do we respond to the stories of faith that we've received? This morning's liturgy, our call to worship, our confessional prayers, all of this was the result of time I spent reading through several psalms and the Isaiah reading that Barbara read for us. The psalmist proclaims, "One generation commends your works, O God, to another generation." And because I'm a nerd for all things church and polity, in the UCC Constitution, there's also a line that states, it's the responsibility of each generation to make the faith its own. So we're not only about receiving our past stories, we're also about the business of making these stories our own. So, as we continue to prayerfully listen to what the voice of God is still doing in our midst today, I want to invite and challenge and encourage us today to a practice of receiving, discerning, and acting. So when we think about receiving, when we contemplate this idea of what is worship, What stories, traditions, beliefs have we received from our faith ancestors about worship? The Hebrew Bible has many narratives about this. Way in the beginning pages, the stories of Abraham and Sarah and their children talk about God appearing in dreams and visions and in the stars. They told their children about those visions and dreams. Moses and the people of God who wandered in the desert were accompanied by God as a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night. They worshiped a God who was among them and with them in their wandering and travels. When these wanderers established a home, they heard the stories of a God showing up in natural phenomenon, a God who traveled with them. And through discerning God's voice, this new generation adapted their worship practices and built a tent or a tabernacle for God. So no matter where the people were, God's presence was always found within the fabric of this holy space. Later generations grew up from these stories being handed down one after another, and stories of a traveling God were told to a generation of people that were no longer traveling. And once they found a home, they established a home, they thought, well, God needs a home too. So they built the temple. Now, we could follow this particular temple story for literally thousands and thousands of years, because the people's quest for where to worship God went through several exiles. The people of God were taken from their homes that they built around the temple, and they were taken to other lands. So they had to figure out, well, how do we worship God in our temple when we're not anywhere near our temple? They eventually got to come back home, but it wasn't really them, it was their children, their descendants. So these people were coming home to a place they'd never been. So once again, they had to do the work of adapting. What does it mean to worship God? And this pattern of exile and return happens numerous times throughout the history of the Hebrew people. Jesus himself knew about these stories and commented on them. Our story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman talking at the well, other than talking about fine and five husbands, was about talking about the right place to worship God. She wanted to know the proper worship logistics. She asks Jesus, "All right, where's the right place to worship? Because your ancestors and my ancestors talk about two very different places." And as is usually the case, there's more than just two versions to that story. The reason there are two very distinct places of worship is the result of generations of war. The kingdom of Israel split into two kingdoms, the northern and the southern. And they fought over land, they fought over power, they fought over food and water and cultural practices. And these two kingdoms were taken into exile by different nations at different times. And now that I'm hearing myself say this, it seems like worship and war are pretty connected. Okay. So the stories of why worship changed for the people of God seems, I guess, that it was directly connected to the wars in which they were involved. And again, the Hebrew Bible is filled with pages of battles fought because judges, kings, rulers, they wanted to protect the people of God from the influence of the outside nations, the others. The Christian testaments were written during the Roman occupation. So there was literally military presence in their home as they were writing about what God is doing in their life. We jump forward a few hundred years or so, and the Crusades of the Middle Ages were waged because Christians didn't like that Muslims wanted to worship in the same place they did. Whew. Well, that's loaded. So I guess if we're doing this practice of receiving, we have to consider that our stories of faith have a history of war, battle, death, denomination in our lineage. We might not have been directly involved in those wars or those campaigns, but we are responsible for how our community responds to conflicts that happen within our midst. So the woman at the well actually is very wise. She's received the stories of her ancestors and her faith. And she's sitting in front of someone else that she knows is a teacher who's got a lot of stories himself. And so in her act of discernment, she brings to Jesus the question, where do we worship? Who wins the worship wars? And Jesus, being the ever clever teacher, doesn't give her a logistical answer about where to worship. Instead, he offers a commentary about how to worship, in spirit and in truth. Now, I'm going to ask us for just a moment to take a leap and take Jesus at his word. I know. But hear me out. Because there are times when Jesus offers very direct and explicit responses. What's the greatest commandment? He says, love God, love your neighbor. Pretty straightforward. Someone asked, are we supposed to pay taxes? He says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. But this is not exactly a direct answer. The woman says, where's the right place to worship God? And Jesus says, it doesn't matter. We're going to focus on worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Well, that got us nowhere. So let's go back a little further. It seems the question of where to worship is a moving target, changing and adapting with each generation of faithful people. So, what stories have we received about how to worship? All creation praises God, the psalmist says. The stars, the planets, the waters, creatures of the deep, snow, tree, every hill, each bug and beast, all of creation is a reflection of the goodness of God. The kind of worship I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice, untie the cords, set the prisoners free, share your food with the hungry. When you see the naked, clothe them. Do not turn away from your own flesh and blood. Then you will be like a well-watered garden, a spring whose water never fails. Jesus says to the Samaritan woman, if you only knew the gift God has for you and who you're speaking to, you would ask me and I would give you living water. Water seems to be utilized again and again by the biblical writers across all the centuries. The poems of creation in Genesis speak of the Spirit of God hovering over the deep waters. When the Hebrews are set free from the Egyptians, they journey across the sea. And in a desert region where most of our stories of faith are set, water is a precious resource. The book Kim read for us told us that too. Water is life. Water is sacred. It flows through us. Water is life, and life is worth fighting for. I did a quick Google search. How many wars have been fought over water? And it gave me about 13,000. I didn't read them all. Some of the earliest dated back to 2500 BCE in Mesopotamia, where nations were fighting over who got to control the water. Because if you controlled the water, you controlled the crops, you controlled the money. Fast forward a couple thousand years, and in 1970, the Ku Klux Klan poisoned water sources owned by Black Muslim communities. So in poisoning the water, they destroyed their farms and livestock, they made the entire community sick, and they were essentially wiped off the map. Even in 2022, Russian armies destroyed Ukrainian dams. So this one's a little bit easier to see, I guess, how war and water are connected. Okay, so maybe the title wasn't really a misprint, but you get it, right? So if we know worship and war can go hand in hand, and we know water and war can go hand in hand, what about worship and water? After all, water is one of the most precious resources we have on earth. Every single biochemical process that occurs in plants and animals and habitats requires water to function. Without water, there is no life. Jesus speaks of not just water, but living water. So maybe water and worship are also connected. First thing that comes to mind is baptism. In our worship setting, baptism is a ritual, a sacrament that combines water and word and community to make visible the invisible promises of an ever-present God. The latest issue of The Courier that Barbara wrote again about this book talks about the pledge of the water protectors, where we commit to treating Mother Earth that is filled with water and land, treating Mother Earth with love and respect. The bread we use in communion cannot be grown or baked without water. Water is life. Water creates life. We cry tears of water and salt when we grieve death or loss or pain. And we sweat water and salt when we're working and laboring in this life. So how are we supposed to become living water? The prophets and Jesus seem to suggest that by worshiping God, by participating in this ongoing adaptation, we become like living water. Meaning, when we worship God in spirit and in truth, we as a community will be able to cultivate and sustain life-affirming practices for this earth and its inhabitants. Way back when I started talking, I asked us to consider receiving, discerning, and acting. Well, we've received an abundance of messages about worship and water and war and our human participation in these activities. So now comes the work of discernment. When we worship, like we're doing now, are we most concerned about where we worship? Are we focused on what can be done for us in worship? Do we ask, maybe not out loud, but maybe to ourselves, well, what am I getting out of this? Why would I go? I mean, after all, Jesus himself offered to give living water. So shouldn't we be coming to worship to receive? It's tempting to dwell on these questions and not to move further in discernment. And perhaps we even want the co-pastors to imitate Jesus and pour out on us as the gathered community. We want them to pour out on us their teaching, their pastoral presence, their healing, you know, their healing touch, prayers, love. But I think we must press on further still. The stories of our faith are filled with specific examples of suffering and hardship that the gathered community knows intimately and is called to respond to. The Psalms point to very specific contextual issues of war and famine, exile, death, loss of community, illness. The writers use real-life events of what's happening now, here and now, to point to what concerns God. And when the people of God get rebuked or when they get in trouble, it's because the community is silent or absent from the places and people that God is most concerned with. So are we showing up to a building on Sunday morning to show God that we're good people? I mean, on the one hand, our presence here does make a statement of solidarity. Our presence here offers shelter to one another for our own broken hearts. It affirms our connection and commitment to the community. But living water is not stagnant. It was living water that carved the Grand Canyon, that falls from the skies to water the crops and our livestock and ourselves. Living water shapes its surroundings precisely because it is in motion. On the Ames UCC website, there's a note to visitors that when you come here, you might experience a variety of theologies and beliefs about God and the divine. But there is a single commitment to being in loving relationship with one another. Love isn't stagnant either, dear ones. We've already been committed to being and becoming living water, which means we are already situated to be in motion, to be in transition, and to growth. We know that worship and water can be powerful forces that drag humanity towards violence and domination. But this does not seem like a course we would want to set. To fight over worship logistics, to build resentment instead of relationship, to separate instead of connecting, to dismiss instead of practicing curiosity, that can be a very lonely road. In receiving the gifts of our stories of faith, in discerning what God calls us to worship, how God calls us to worship in spirit and truth, I don't think that we can faithfully conclude that we were meant to stay in one place to do all of those things. So then, beloveds, what actions will we take in light of the hard and difficult work that's already been done over the past years? And I'm not just talking about these last few interim years. I'm talking about from when the first brick was laid for this building. I'm talking before that, when the group of random community members decided, hey, maybe we could join together and make a larger community. I'm talking even before that, before there has been work that has been done on our behalf by people we will never meet. But when we say there's a community of saints, we invite their presence and their influence among us. So I ask again, what actions will we take? What will spring forth after this time of transition opens up? May the living waters flow over us. Hardened or set in our ways though we may be, may the water soften our edges and engender us to desire justice and mercy for ourselves and one another. May the waters rise up within us, breaking over the floodgates that keep us sitting comfortably in these pews, and may we be swept up by the current of the Spirit, who calls us and carries us out into our community, that we might be in deeper relationship, not only with one another, but with our neighbors. And may we become like the tides of the ocean. Once they've receded from shore, they move, they build, they churn, and once again return from the place that they were sent. So too may we grow to recognize the living water around us and within us, calling us to this place, sending us from this place, and calling us and sending us again and again. For is this not the kind of worship to which we are called, in spirit and in truth, to do justice and to love mercy and to travel humbly with God? Amen.